Hey, Scott Spears back with you here, hour number two of the Now program today, and we are having a great time. We want to thank our guest from hour number one, the amazing Kreskin, for joining us. He's always a lot of fun, regular staple on this program, and always thought-provoking when the amazing Kreskin joins us. Now, this hour is going to be a lot of fun for a myriad of reasons. Now, nobody could have predicted this any better. Our fifth anniversary, WWGH Radio's fifth anniversary of this program, will be coming up with a big two-hour special on Monday, June the 10th, 7:15 to 9 p.m. on this station. That event will be supported by Domino's Pizza, telephone number 740-383-3030. Now, over the course of this program, we have had a lot of great guests on. We've had Hugh Downs. We have had David Hartman. We have had Marvin Kalb and Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, Jesse Jackson, just great people, people who are no longer with us, Tony Curtis and Phyllis Diller and Jane Meadows and all the great guests we've had over the last 5 years. But today, making a very special appearance with us, is a gentleman who's been on before. He is an icon in the world of news without question. You have probably been watching him and listening to him for more than a half century. I have enjoyed so much seeing him on CNN as of late, commenting during the Anderson Cooper program or the Chris Cuomo program. He is one of the best. He was the co-host of the legendary news magazine Primetime Live. He was a White House news correspondent, asking tough questions of all the presidents, including Reagan and Clinton. And he was the host of the This Week program on Sunday morning, which still airs on ABC, along with Cokie Roberts. And interestingly enough, I say this not only for our fifth anniversary, but today, the 75th anniversary of D-Day. Nobody better to have on than the professional's professional. We know he doesn't do these appearances often anymore, but to have him for this hour today is tremendous, and my introduction is now over, long enough to say, here is Sam Donaldson. Sam, how are you?
Well, Scott, I'm pleased to be with you. I mean, you're persistent, you're smart. I understand that you've been on the air for 5 years, and I must tell you, I was a reporter in Washington for 52 years. The next 47 is the easiest. I mean, the first five was the hardest, Scott.
You know, it's interesting, Sam. I was talking to somebody the other day over a few radio stations. I've been doing this for 17 years, and boy, I'll tell you, it never gets old.
No, it never gets old, and it's always interesting if you are smart and if you keep up on the topics that people are interested in. And the list of guests you've had, I mean, you say I'm an icon. I must say to you, and I think I've said this before, the word icon is one word away from the word calcified. So if you don't mind, drop the icon.
How's legendary sit with you?
Well, legendary, it could go two ways. I mean, we think of the people in history who are legends. Some of them we think are great and wonderful, and we'd like to have known them, and others, thank God, they're gone. So, I don't know. It's sort of a neutral word.
Sam, I wanted to spend a little bit of time here just talking about a gentleman who is still with us, 98 years old. He was on this program so often, one of your colleagues at ABC, Hugh Downs, an Ohio boy. He was on this program right up until the election of 2016, so well past his 95th birthday. I loved you. What are your memories of Hugh Downs?
Well, Hugh Downs, of course, was terrific. NBC was where I think most people began to know him, with the Today Show. And then, of course, he came to ABC and worked for many years with us. I say us. I'm retired, of course, but it's still home. And on 2020 and other programs. Hugh used to say that he had reinvented himself every 10 years. I mean, he did something new. He did something different. And he said, well, that keeps me young. Of course, when you get to be 95 or 97, it probably takes a little bit more than that. But I remember him fondly, and I liked him very much.
Very good guy. A few other names I want to fly by here. David Brinkley. David Brinkley was so great. You were on the round table so many years with him on the Sunday morning show. What was it like to work with David Brinkley?
Well, let me tell you, it was a real pleasure when you knew him and could listen to him talk. I mean, he was very interesting. He was very wry and all of that. But his voice, the diction that he developed, I think was part of it. I mean, if I said to you, Scott, I went downtown, I couldn't find anything to do, so I came home, well, that's boring. But David would say, well, I went downtown, I couldn't find anything to do, so I came home. And that's pretty interesting. I can remember many things that he did on our program at ABC. Like Hugh, he changed networks. He'd been with NBC for 33 years. He and Chet Huntley had at one time the most watched and listened television newscast in the country, and I think probably in the world. And then after Chet retired and went back to Montana, the chemistry wasn't the same. David was still very good, but that magic that when you put people together, it just works. Like the late Rune Arledge in the sports department, he puts together for Monday Night Football, Dandy Don and Crank Gifford and Howard Cosell, and it all worked. You take any one of them and put them separately, and it's not the same. So when David came to ABC, NBC just sort of let him go, and Rune Arledge was smart enough to pick it up, put him on Sunday, and he was the king of the Sunday broadcast as long as he did the program. My memory of David is he was a great mentor and a lot of fun to be with.
Sam, I've got to ask you this. You were there on that famous night, election night 1996. Bill Clinton had just won re-election by a pretty good margin over Bob Dole. He gave a very long speech that night, and they went back to the studio. You were there. Peter Jennings was there. David Brinkley was there and a few others. And David said something that you shouldn't say on network television. What happened that night?
Well, what happened is David had stayed too long. I think if the good Lord blesses you with enough sense, or someone else has enough sense to move you on gently and but firmly, when your time is up, before you then lose it. And I'm not just talking about the broadcast business. Of course, I'm talking about any business or any profession or any craft or any work that you do. Well, you're very lucky. David was not that lucky. He'd stayed too long, and his mental faculties were beginning to go. And so he thought we hadn't come back on the air, and he said something like, I don't remember the exact words, well, Bill Clinton has never had a good thought or an important thought in his life. And I said, David, we're on the air. You can't say that. And he said, oh, you're not on the air. And Peter Jennings said, yes, David, we are on the air. Well, David was mortified, of course, and he apologized directly later to President Clinton. But it's just an example of someone in any walk of life, including politics, obviously. If you stay too long, your glory days are behind you. And what you're doing now is not just selling your reputation. Who cares about that? I mean, you go on. But the point is, you now, if you're a politician particularly, you're not doing the public any good. You're doing the harm. You were once great. You're no longer great. So leave.
I want to talk about one of your former colleagues before we move on to D-Day here, because there was a book written, about a month ago, about Barbara Walters and her involvement with The View. And, of course, we haven't seen Barbara for a few years. I think she's living in retirement now. What was Barbara Walters like? You were on The View a few times. What kind of person was she?
Well, I liked her immensely. When she came to ABC, we were all skeptical of ABC paid her $1 million, the first $1 million contract in the history of broadcast news, certainly. And she was teamed with Harry Reasoner, who had come from CBS earlier. and the two of them didn't work at all. Barbara's forte was not that of principal anchor. Now, if you just think, Scott, about the principal anchors that you and perhaps even older generations have known over the years, going back to the Cronkite days and the Huntley-Brinkley days, and then moving forward, our Peter Jennings and Tom Brokaw and Dan Rather, and moving forward, she was not the principal anchor. She was one of the best interviewers, though, I have ever met. She knew her stuff. She followed up. She made an interview interesting, whether it was a Hollywood star, whether it was Colin Powell, who was then chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And I just thought the world of her, because when she then was taken off the evening news, our evening news, as one of the principal anchors, she began to do interviews, and one of the first trips that Jimmy Carter took abroad, she came along. And it was just terrific when I really got to know her at a situation like that. And we had a lot of fun with Barbara and Ted Koppel, and just sort of made a trio of it as we went to India with Jimmy Carter and to Egypt and, of course, originally to Poland.
Sam, it's kind of interesting because, and I'm not sure that this was a knock on her in this book, which I guess was considered a tell-all, but it basically was that off-camera she was tough. She was maybe sometimes difficult, that, you know, she wanted things her way, and that's the way it was. And I remember talking to Hugh Downs about her when she retired back in 2014, and I remember you saying he thought it would be hard for her to retire because that was her life. And he liked Barbara a lot. Is that her? Is she tough?
I think she could be tough. I never found her that way because I was really in never direct competition with her. Oh, maybe once or twice, but it didn't matter. If you were in competition, and Hugh was in competition with her as a co-anchor and other reporters on 2020, Barbara wanted her share, and her share was often first, or her share was often a couple of minutes more. But she always let you live, too. I've known some people in this business who wanted their share and they wanted to make certain you didn't get yours at all. In other words, it's the old saying, not only shall I succeed, but my enemies must fail. That was not Barbara. I didn't find her toughness to be something like that. However, you're quite right. She was barely a loner. She had two marriages, and they were not great marriages. I didn't know her when she had her first marriage, and she had a daughter. But the second marriage didn't work out. And why, she knew everybody in New York, and she, the country knew her. I mean, one of the famous country songs was about, oh, Barbara Walters, I'm ready for my interview. But I think privately, she didn't have the kind of home life or the kind of affection that we all seek.
It just occurred to me, a few months ago, we were lucky enough to have on the daughter of Sarah McClendon, legendary White House.
The Rose of Tyler, Texas.
Oh, and if people don't remember Sarah, go to C-SPAN.com and look up Sarah McClendon, find some of her press conferences, and look at the interview Sam did with her. I think it was back in 96, late in Sarah's life. But I remember, Sam, you and Sarah talking, because I've watched that interview, and you talked about how if you are nice as a journalist, if you are kind, if you let other people ask the question first, you will not succeed. And I thought of that when you were talking about Barbara Walters.
Well, if I said those exact words, I would like to amend them. You can be nice and you can be kind and still be a good journalist. My point was, you have to be aggressive. If you want to be laid back, take your time, that's fine. And there are parts of journalism in which that will work. Write a great biography. Here is Robert Caro still working on Volume 5 of Lyndon Johnson. I don't know we'll ever see it because it's taken him about 15, 20 years to get. He got to Volume 4 and got to the point where Lyndon was President of the United States, so it's the big one coming. That's what I meant by being aggressive. Sarah was terrific. All the people you've mentioned, I say, are terrific. It can't be all true, I suppose, but you happen to hit the ones I really thought were. Sarah McClendon was a WAC in World War II, Women's Army Corps. And she always took care of the veterans. Her entire life as a reporter was multifaceted, but the main thing was the veterans. I'll never forget one question she asked Ronald Reagan. I don't remember the exact question. It was something like, well, Mr. President, today we learned that the Veterans Administration has let the veterans down in this department. How can your administration do that? I mean, how can you possibly forsake our veterans? Reagan looked at her and said, Sarah, how can you say such a terrible thing about such a nice guy like me? The one time I saw Sarah flounced by a president, because she was one who never gave an inch when it came to trying to hold the feet to the fire.
There's one more name I've got to touch on, and I think I've told this story before, but she was a regular on this program, and I loved her, and I'm looking at a picture of her right now. Helen Thomas. What made Helen so unique?
Well, Helen was one of the women who brought women into big-time reporting in Washington, D.C. I remember when I first went to a press club up there, it was Prime Minister Nehru of India. I was much younger and new reporter in town. The women were all up in the balcony. This was a dinner, a lunch, and the women were in those days not allowed on the floor of the press club for lunch. They could sit in the balcony if they wanted to report on the guest speaker. And with several others, was one who fought very hard, particularly and successfully, to bring women into the first-class positions in the press corps. And she became president of the Gridiron Club and all of the things that go with it. What made her special was, when Helen, we knew, those of us who got to know her well, knew her politics. We knew exactly how she felt about almost all subjects, because we talk about them in private. But you could never, in her work for United Press International, in my view, never saw a story in which you said, oh, she's colored it with her opinion. She's how she feels about this, and look, there it is. She played it straight right down the middle when she was with the wire service. Later on, she became a commentator when UPI folded, and she went out, and then she gave her opinions, and she stayed too long, because she had a misfortune toward the end, and some people say, well, that ruined her reputation. No, the body of her work was such that that one thing she did, that one bad scene, was something that I think will not ruin her in history in broadcasting, because she also did radio and in journalism.
It's interesting, and before we move on to DD, because I think I've told this story before, but I went and interviewed Helen after she was let go from her position for her comments on Palestine and Israel, and she told me, because we did the interview at her apartment in Washington, she said, because everybody was distancing themselves from Helen Thomas, her publisher.
Not everybody.
Well, that's you. Her publisher did. Hearst let her go. She said the only two people who called her were Jimmy Carter and Sam Donaldson.
No, when I make a friend and I think I know someone's character and all of that, I'm not going to distance myself from them. I told Helen, because of that incident, it was a hot summer day. She was at the White House sitting outside, and a rabbi came along with a video camera to just ask questions about the anniversary of the State of Israel's founding or something, but having to do with Israel. And ask very politely, Miss Thomas, what can you tell us about your view of Israel? And she said, well, they should all go home, back where they came from, because Helen is Lebanese. And again, Helen felt very strongly, as we knew, about the situation with the Palestinians and with the Israel, but never let it get into her copy. Well, of course, the rabbi took that video and used it, which he had every right to do. My friend Richard Cohen, who still is a very fine op-ed columnist for the Washington Post, said, Miss Thomas said we should all go back where we came from. Oh, Germany, Poland. We Jews very, very well there, didn't we? Cutting and very cutting, but I said to Helen, Helen, the next time someone asks you a question and you have feelings that you don't really think you ought to talk about, just say what you taught me to say. No comment.
Sam, I want to go 75th anniversary of D-Day today. I think back to the great speeches that Ronald Reagan made on anniversaries of D-Day, other presidents. What are your memories when you think 75th anniversary of D-Day?
Well, I'll answer your question, but I'm going to start with something for me and maybe some of your listeners who have heard me on your broadcast before. Seems to be uncharacteristic. I want to praise Donald J. Trump. The President of the United States rose to the occasion. First of all, the person or people who wrote his speech for him hit every right note. Everything I think should be said or touched on, President Trump touched on it in a very dignified, eloquent way. And he delivered the speech well. Not once did you hear him praise himself. Not once was it all about him. It was about the heroes. It was about the boys from small and large towns in the country who went, stormed the beaches at Normandy, knowing that many of them would not come back. And 4,400, I think, was the number killed on D-Day on that beach. At least that was the number he used, and I think you probably can check it. So let me just begin by saying I think we could be proud of the president's presentation today as he spoke it. Now, question is, for instance, in the speech he talked about the strong alliance, we're talking about NATO, that was preserved after World War II and that keeps the peace today. Now, it's an alliance that he has dunned. When he first came, he couldn't understand why we had to follow Article 5, which is the guts of the alliance, which says any member nation of NATO attacked will receive the immediate assistance of all the other nations. He said, well, I'm not sure I don't want to do that. What? Well, Jim Mattis, who was the defense secretary, finally talked in saying, okay, Article 5. And he says that the NATO members, others, haven't paid their dues. They haven't paid up. They should pay. Well, he still thinks, apparently, that someone writes a check, that Angela Merkel of Germany writes a check for the Bundestag Bank. And no. No one pays money directly into NATO from the standpoint of their share. What they're obligated to do, each one of us, including obviously the United States, is to build up their own armed forces, and that takes money, to a certain level. And I think the level varies with various countries, although I'm not an expert on NATO. But he didn't do that today. It was great. Now, my memories, shall I go on or shall I stop and let you get in? It's your program, Scott.
Go right ahead.
All right. My first visit with the president was with Jimmy Carter. It was not an anniversary year, but he went to Normandy with President Giscard d'Estaing of France, and you heard their version of what we heard today. Today, President Macron of France spoke, and then President Trump of the United States, and President Carter, President Giscard. My next president was Ronald Reagan. It was the 40th, and it, for me, will be the great one. Reagan also had a terrific speechwriter. She wrote a speech at Pont de Hoc. I've never heard Reagan better, and he was good at almost everything. They staged at that cliff, 100 yards high, 100 feet high, rather. Well, it's either feet or yards. You'll check the record, please. Our Rangers climbed it into deadly German machine gun fire, thinking that there was an artillery replacement right behind it that could blow our ships the day out of the water. Actually, it was about 3 kilometers back. But the White House staged it. They brought the old guys who had climbed the cliffs. They put them there. Michael Deaver, who was the Hollywood guy who came with Ronald Reagan, and often said, people credit me with all these staging. Hey, you've got Reagan to work with. It's child's play. And the press corps was around, so the sun was right. And Peggy Noonan, the speechwriter, I can hear Reagan today. These are the boys of Pont de Hoc. These are the boys, pointing to the old men, who won the war. These are the boys who made the peace. I mean, you Britain. I turned to Jim Baker, who was the chief of staff at the White House at the time, and said, well, you got me. If I had had any thought of trying to find something to criticize here, forget it. this is going hot, straight, and true, just like the president spoke it. And then he went to the Normandy beach, and he went to the, of course, the cemetery at Normandy, and did a wonderful speech there. The 40th was something special, at least it was for me. And I think Reagan, as the president, brought to the scene something that Jimmy Carter hadn't, that George W. Bush didn't, that Bill Clinton didn't. And with the exception that I've already given him the praise that I think he deserves, and the people who wrote his speech, President Trump did for that speech. Now, elsewhere on this trip, he's been the Trump we know, and the one that I often criticize, but not today.
When we're drawing some, I'm going to say parallels between President Reagan and President Trump here, there has been an interesting thing going on as of late. Patty Davis, President Reagan's daughter, has been writing some columns recently, saying her father would be horrified with what's going on with the Republican Party. She's very critical of President Trump. She recently said, don't pull the family card with bringing your family to see the royalty in England. Patty Davis, during President Reagan's years in the White House, and even somewhat after, did not get along with him. I certainly don't think they were of the same politics. Do you think Ronald Reagan would be horrified with what's going on today?
Well, I don't know whether the word is horrified, but clearly the Republican Party today is a party headed by Donald J. Trump. He's co-opted the old Republicans, and by old I don't necessarily mean in age only, but the Republicans who used to stand for free trade, fiscal responsibility, go up and down the line. That's a different party. And to a large extent, as you see, it pays homage to Trump and Trumpism. If Trump says tariffs on everything, which is a terrible idea, who will tell you that? What? Me? The liberals? No. Look what's happening at the Senate at the moment. On the thought that he might, in fact, go through with putting tariffs on Mexico, Republican senators have now sent the word publicly, we will stop you. And this is amazing. But, of course, something has to stop him when he does things like that. So, yes, I would think that President Reagan, who was a free trader, would not approve. Also, listen to President Reagan's last speech that he gave as president. It was this farewell speech from the Oval Office. And toward the end, he talked about that shining city on the hill that he often referred to and said that was what the United States was for the rest of the world. And he talked about the fact that we welcomed immigrants. We wanted them to come here. And he said if there have to be walls, there have to be doors, and the doors have to be open to everyone. He didn't say, but not Muslims from seven different countries. And he didn't say, well, not the Mexicans over there, you know, including, pardon me, but I'm just quoting, as you know, the rapists. He didn't say those things because he didn't believe those things. Reagan is often accused of having a prejudice. He had certain prejudices. Of course he did. But they were not the kinds of prejudices that we are used to when we use the word. He would take a person of any color and of any stripe and of any religion on the merits of that person. He actually lived, I think, Dr. King's famous admonition that he wanted his children to be judged not by the color of the skin, but by the color, but by the character. So I think I could go up and down the line of various things that President Reagan did, that President Trump actually does the opposite, or clearly will say that he doesn't approve of that. I do not believe that Ronald Reagan would ever have said of John McCain, a true hero in our country, the man who spent 7 years in prison in Hanoi, been shot down by the Vietnamese, and when they offered him release because they discovered his father was the commander-in-chief of all U.S. forces in the Pacific, Admiral John S. McCain. He said, I'm not going without my buddies. I'm not going without the other American prisoners. He stayed. He almost died. And to have someone say, well, I don't like people who are captured and have a running fight even a year after his death, can't let it go. Donald Trump can't let it go, his animosity toward John McCain. Ronald Reagan didn't act that way. You touched a nerve here, Scott, and I'm going to stop here because I'd take up your hour and the next one with what I think are some differences between those two men.
Maybe the bigger question, maybe the wider question when it comes to Ronald Reagan. I remember when Ronald Reagan died in 2004, the outpouring was tremendous. And we've had presidents die since then. George H.W. Bush, Jerry Ford have both passed away since then. And they had big, there was an outpouring, but not like for President Reagan. And prior to President Reagan, the Republicans really had a hard time pointing to somebody back to Eisenhower, who was a beloved figure in their party. It became Reagan. Even in Democratic primaries, Reagan, Hillary Clinton and President Obama were talking about Ronald Reagan. Has Trump now eclipsed Reagan in that way? When Trump is no longer president, is that who the Republicans are going to point to?
No, I don't believe so. I mean, the Republican Party has changed. I think it will modify back to much of what it stood for, but of course I can't tell the future. But certainly President Trump cannot hold a candle to Ronald Reagan in many respects. I heard Ronald Reagan lie once. His first statement after the story that we had been selling arms to Iran in exchange for hostages was in the Roosevelt Room, and he just said to reporters, "This story out of Lebanon has no foundation." Well, you know, you can parse words. President Trump lies repeatedly. He lies every day. He lies in what he says. Let me give you an example. You talk about the combination. President Trump said earlier today, now the time before he left his golf course where he'd been spending the night in Scotland to go to Normandy, he said that he had the highest support rating in the Republican Party, among Republicans, of any Republican president. He's very proud of that. Well, it's not true. He said that he had 94% rating, and he said that Ronald Reagan only had an 86% rating. That's not true. Now you say, well, he was misinformed. Anyone can make a mistake. Well, he makes those kinds of mistakes almost every time he opens his mouth. The fact is, Ronald Reagan had a 94% rating. The highest rating was George W. Bush right after 9/11. He had a 99% rating. And President Trump has at the moment, according to Gallup's, he has a 90% rating. He is sixth of seven post-World War II Republican presidents as far as the high rating goes. Well, Ronald Reagan made mistakes when he said things. He said things that weren't true, but he thought they were true. I mean, I'll never forget questioning one time about the Challenger, which blew up, and the finding was that the O-rings had frozen at Cape Kennedy, and being frozen at 72 seconds, they collapsed, and the whole thing blew up and killed everybody. And I asked him if someone was going to be held accountable. I said, sir, if a railroad engineer falls asleep or makes a mistake and a lot of people are killed on the train, he's brought before a court and examined as to reasons. And, well, President Reagan said, no one knew that it was that cold at the Kennedy Space Center. No one knew that. It was warm in Florida. Well, every winter it got cold below freezing there. He didn't know it. So I don't call it a lie. I mean, a lie is something where you say, well, you know better. And he would often do those things. But, again, with that one exception, and you can parse whether you would have done the same thing, I never heard him say something that he clearly, I think, knew was untrue.
Sam, since we spoke last, the Mueller report has come out, the long-awaited Mueller report. We got the Barr version, and then we did get the full version with some redactions, and we've also heard Mueller speak now, apparently about 8 minutes long, and apparently the only time he wants to speak, he wants the report to do the talking, doesn't want to testify in front of Congress. What did you make of the Mueller report and his 8-minute speech a couple weeks ago?
Well, I thought the Mueller report, which I happen to have read, is it 440 pages? And many of the pages it talked about court cases, of course, I just had to take the word. I don't know the court cases. And a lot of people, I think, who think they want to comment about the Mueller report in Congress, we discover, haven't read it. They know what their party says about it or what someone else says about it. And so my admonition to your listeners is, folks, it's online. It's free. Go read it. Particularly part two, which is obstruction of justice. Part one, which is the Russian connection, is also important. Well, my view is, knowing I got to know Bob Mueller a little bit in Washington, I think he's a straight arrow, and unless someone comes up with some evidence, I'm going to believe that he and his team very carefully tried to follow evidence and do it without partisanship and do it without favor. So I'll accept the Mueller report from the standpoint that he was not able to find a connection that fit the definition of a crime from the standpoint of the Trump campaign and the Russians. Yes, plenty of evidence there. The Trump campaign welcomed the Russians, and you'll never forget if you watch the debate when Donald Trump himself publicly called out to the Russians, "You find those 30,000 missing emails of Hillary Clinton's. I hope you find them." Well, but they found them. WikiLeaks published them. But there was no direct, except for a public request that anyone could make, connection between the two. All right, fine. Now we get to obstruction. That has been mischaracterized by Attorney General Barr from the get-go, from his first Sunday four-page report to Congress and the American people, as exonerating Trump from the crime of obstruction of justice. Not true. In fact, Mueller makes the point, and Mueller in his little statement the other day made the point, that if they could have found that the president was not guilty of obstruction, they would have said so. They did not say so. And they explained why they didn't say so. There is a Justice Department long-standing rule. It's not in the Constitution. It's not a law. The Justice Department many decades ago simply decided that a sitting president could not be indicted, that the proper time to indict a president was after he or she leaves office. And so Mueller made it plain in his report that they could not exonerate the president. They would not try to indict him because the Justice Department rules forbade it. And to then go forward and complain publicly outside of the report would have been not just bad form. It would have been something that I think everyone would have conceded, and the people who think Jim Comey did make that mistake with Hillary Clinton when he first tried to say that they found nothing, the FBI found nothing to prosecute her for, and then slammed her up and down. That's wrong. And so Mueller played it straight and didn't do that. But if you read the report, I'll tell you this. The moment he leaves office, unless someone pardons him, he can be brought to court. Not Bob Mueller, Donald J. Trump.
On that note, between the Southern District, where he's already been named, we're pretty sure, as an unindicted co-conspirator. They use that a lot. And he can't be pardoned, it's my understanding, in the Southern District of New York of those crimes. And what you just talked about, the Mueller report, and the moment he's no longer president, possibly being brought up on those charges, indicted. Is there any chance that Donald Trump, when he leaves office, isn't indicted somewhere?
I think there'll be a lot of push for it, but whether it happens or not, whether it would be really good for the country or not, I can't make a judgment now. I thought Gerald Ford was wrong to pardon Richard Nixon. He surely would have been brought to court, tried by a jury of his peers, because we have the evidence of the tapes from his own voice, convicted of obstruction of justice. And then the question was, would he be jailed or not? But in the case of Trump, what would be good for the country? Because I sense have changed my mind. I think Gerry Ford was right to pardon Nixon, only not to save Nixon, but to let the country begin to move on from that. If Nixon had been brought to court, Watergate would still have been topic number A, right there. No other business could be left. The partisanship would have been, and the great divide would have been even sharper, and I think that's probably wrong. But I'll tell you this. Look at Bill Clinton. On the day Bill Clinton left office, the independent counsel, a man named Robert Ray, he took Kenneth Starr's place when Starr moved on, said to the White House, the president will either acknowledge that he gave false testimony under oath to the judge that Saturday in Washington when he denied having any sexual relationship with Monica Lewinsky. He'll either acknowledge that he did give false testimony, or I will indict him. I will bring him to court. And so on the day he left office, you can read it. It's a public document. President Clinton did not publicly come forward and speak, but the document, the President of the United States acknowledges that he gave false testimony under oath, which is the classical definition of perjury.
Sam, two quick questions I want to get in here in the last 5 minutes we have, and
okay,
I think
make
they're
them long questions. I have to have some water, or my voice will give out.
Those short questions, maybe just a yes/no on this one. Hillary Clinton, after reading the Mueller report, how is Hillary Clinton? Is she a tragic figure in history now because of that election and the things that went on?
Well, I mean, you either like her, or you don't like her, and a lot of people didn't like her, or she would have been elected president. On the merits, she ran a campaign which basically was a campaign saying, I'm not him, and she wasn't him. But she never told us who she was that was likable from the standpoint of what she would do for us and why. I like Hillary Clinton. I first met her when we and other reporters and junior staff members of the House Impeachment Committee, looking at Richard Nixon, would stand in the hall when the doors were closed, the members were debating something, and talk to her. I think her heart was in the right place. She often said, I'm not my husband. I don't have his gift of being able to talk to people. I don't have his... And she was it, and she couldn't touch... No one could touch Bill Clinton in his prime from that standpoint. But I think Lord Acton, about power corrupting and all power corrupts completely. When they left the White House, I think the Clintons and Hillary was part of that, lunched up to an extent that other presidents may have wanted to, but didn't. And Jimmy Carter, of course, the antithesis of the president who doesn't try to lunch up because of his role. So I think it's tragic. I think Shakespeare could write a great, great play.
Final question, Sam, before we let you go here. We are less than a month away. Matter of fact, this month we will have the first, can you imagine, first Democratic primary, our first Democratic candidate debate for president. We've got a lot of people in here. Obviously, Joe Biden sticks out, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren. Pete Buttigieg has come out of nowhere. We've got de Blasio from New York and a whole lot of other people running for office. Does anybody besides Joe Biden stick out, and is this his race to lose?
Well, I think it's his race to lose for the nomination. For instance, and they're positioning myself, the Biden people, to try to say, we think we can get the nomination, now we have to get elected. They're taking nothing for granted. For instance, he's just reaffirmed his support for the Hyde Amendment, an amendment which said that people on Medicare, women on Medicare, would not get money for abortions unless it was rape, incest, or the life of the mother. Now, that's out of step with the Democratic Party now. Out of step, certainly, with all the people on the left running for the nomination. But in my view, he's done this because, A, he believes it, and, B, he thinks he can get the nomination, but he has to win the election, and he has to appeal to many more people than the left part of the Democratic Party, or he'll lose. He'll lose to Trump.
In your opinion, who's number two right now? behind Biden?
I don't know. I mean, it's a crowded field. Kamala Harris, I think, is attractive from the standpoint of what she says and some of her positions. Elizabeth Warren is kind of coming back from a low point where Donald Trump's accusation of the Pocahontas steered her. But there are several very attractive people. I think the one who's not going to make it is Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders, not a Democrat. He's still not a Democrat. He wants to be the Democratic nominee, but not to be a Democrat, which I guess is all right because Trump was a Democrat before he became the Republican nominee. And I think I've said earlier in your program, when your time is over, you should move on. If you stay too long at the dance, it's not fun. And I think it's not going to be fun for Bernie.
Sam, it has been an absolute pleasure to have you here during our fifth anniversary week. Nobody who I'd want to have on more. It's always a pleasure to talk with you. And boy, you kept us informed for a long, long time and are still doing it periodically. I can't thank you enough. The audience can't thank you enough. And I hope every so often you'll come back and join us periodically.
I will when I can, Scott, because I'll repeat it. You're smart, and in the case of trying to get guests, you're persistent, and that pays off.
Stay well, Sam. We'll talk soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Legendary Sam Donaldson. You can't go wrong there. All right. We're done for today, this program, but there's more coming up right around the corner. Stay tuned. This is WWGH Radio. 5 years. But for this day, Scott Spears heading for the dugout.
740-225-4495. Webpage, crteam.com. Thomas Lawn Service for all your lawn care and landscaping needs. Telephone number 74.